Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Friday, the 15th of November, these are our main stories. Investigators looking into the shooting down of a passenger plane over Ukraine have released new phone transcripts linking Russia to the tragedy. The International Criminal Court has authorised an investigation into crimes against Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar. And Italy declares a state of emergency in Venice following catastrophic flooding. Also in this podcast...
Anywhere you see a window in food packaging or even clothing or toys, that could be replaced.
The young scientist that's made a new form of plastic out of fish. Let's start this podcast with a significant development in the mystery of the downing of MH17, the Malaysia Airlines flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, which was shot down over eastern Ukraine in 2014.
We're moving towards unity of command. People with a mandate from Shoigu have been coming here and kicking all the local warlords the f*** out of the units. Uh-huh. And then people from Moscow will take charge.
Uh-huh.
But this does not apply to Makayevka.
You tell me this. I don't care about Makayevka. I need to know one thing. When this happens, who the f*** do I report to?
You will report to the Minister of Defence.
Now, that's part of a phone call that took place almost 5 years ago. The man the voice names is Sergei Shoigu, Russia's defence minister, and international investigators claim it's evidence of links between the Russian government and the separatist leaders in Ukraine, requesting military support and political guidance from Moscow. But a spokeswoman for Russia's foreign ministry said this was more evidence of a stitch-up.
The verdict, the ruling was made right at the very beginning. All that followed was nothing but shoehorning materials to support the chosen tactic of accusations.
So what more do we know about these calls and their significance? I've been talking to our Europe correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
There's a whole swathe of recordings, some of them quite long, and when you delve into them, as the investigators have done, what they hear are separatist commanders, those on the ground in eastern Ukraine fighting against the Ukrainian army, on the phone to senior figures in Russia. And there's a smattering of different figures in Russian military, the Russian leader in Crimea, and also, I think perhaps most significant of all, a man called Vladislav Surkov, who is one of the closest aides to President Putin, one of his right-hand men. He was the deputy head of the presidential administration in the Kremlin for a long time, a deputy prime minister, and a very close architect of the whole of Mr. Putin's sort of grasp on power. And he is heard at one point reassuring one of the leaders of the separatist forces in eastern Ukraine that reinforcements or men and supplies are on their way to help the fight against Ukraine. And this is only 2 weeks before a Russian missile deployed from inside Russia into eastern Ukraine was fired and brought down flight MH17.
Now, in the end, and this is what everyone's always believed anyway, so it doesn't change that. Does it prove it?
Well, it doesn't prove a direct link. What the investigators say it indicates is very close coordination, direction by senior figures in the Russian government, right up to possibly the Kremlin, in directing, supplying, coordinating with the figures on the ground inside eastern Ukraine. Because the Russian contention and some of those rebels has always been that they were nothing to do with Russia, they were just individuals acting on their own accord. This is pretty convincing looking evidence of direct links to the Russian state at a very high level. The nature of the links to the shooting down of MH17 is a little more complex.
So they're asking still for more witnesses to what happened. What stage have we got to with the criminal investigation?
The investigating team is bringing prosecutions against four named individuals, three of them Russians, one Ukrainian, senior figures in the rebel movement in eastern Ukraine. And one of those is one of the figures heard talking to Mr. Surkov on the phone. So their prosecutions should begin in absentia. They haven't handed themselves over, but later next year. And in the meantime, the prosecutors are pursuing, they say, the chain of command, and they say they will pursue it as high as it goes.
Our Europe correspondent Damian Grammaticus. Italy's cabinet has declared a state of emergency in Venice following serious tidal flooding in the city. The country's Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, has said the measure will open the way to providing immediate emergency funds to citizens and businesses which have been affected. He's returned to Rome after visiting Venice, where efforts are continuing to assess the damage. St Mark's Square flooded again at high tide on Thursday, although not to the extent seen late on Tuesday. Those levels were the worst this famous tourist destination has experienced in over 50 years. Our correspondent Jenny Hill is in Venice. So what does the announcement of a state of emergency actually mean?
Well, put simply, it means that the Italian Prime Minister can now start funneling money into Venice, into the clean-up and the restoration operations that need to go on here. It's been really difficult for the people who run tourist businesses here and, of course, for the people who look after Venice's ancient monuments. The 11th century St Mark's Basilica in St Mark's Square here, very famous, of course, but that was quite badly flooded. The crypt, I believe, was rather badly affected. Priests and workers were starting to try and look at what's happened to the stones. They're particularly worried, actually, about the impact of the salt that's in the water on those ancient pieces of marble and so on. There's a lot to do, but, you know, what's really strange is that at the same time, they've been ringing the flood sirens here again, and that's because they're really worried about what's going to happen later on. High tides, very high tides, are expected, and people really fear that actually what they're going to see is flood water pouring back into the city and taking them all back to square one, if you like.
Our correspondent Jenny Hill in Venice. We've also been speaking to one resident, Paola, about the situation.
I'm 50 years old and I never saw in my life water grow at this level. It was an exceptional event and it was really scary. A lot of wind and I had never seen high waves in the lagoon. When I was a child, when we went out to school, was high water. It was normal, but the water could reach up to the knee. Now it's danger because the water reached to the bust. One thing scared me. If one person need help, can't reach the hospital. So in this case, was a big problems. Now the shoppings begin to work, but yesterday was all closed, the shopping, restaurants, bars, and I saw a lot of younger people that help. In Venice, we have 500 church, and a lot of younger students are cleaning a church, museums, everywhere. Of course, the government is helping the population, but the government have to do more.
That's Paola, who lives in Venice. We're all familiar with the ongoing problem of fish consuming plastic particles in the oceans. Our next story is about making plastic out of fish, because one British student has won a prestigious award for doing just that. Lucy Hughes, who's 24 and a graduate in product design from the University of Sussex, came up with a way of turning waste from seafood into carrier bags and packaging and has been rewarded by the International James Dyson Committee. Richard Hamilton has more.
The United Nations says every year the world produces about 50 million tonnes of fish waste. Lucy Hughes's project started off as an investigation into ways of reducing this waste. She carried out her initial research at a fish processing plant in the southern port of New Haven. When she felt the offcuts from fish skins and scales, she sensed they had a lot of potential locked up inside them because of their strength and pliability.
Because it's translucent and flexible, it makes it an ideal alternative for things like packaging windows. So anywhere you see a window in food packaging or even kind of clothing or toys, that could be replaced. The initial phases of the process is very smelly, but by the time you get to an end material, it's virtually odourless.
Her product, called Marinatex, could also be used for sandwich wrappers and an alternative to plastic bags. But unlike plastic, which can remain in the environment for hundreds of years, Marinatex can break down in a home compost or food waste bin within just 4 to 6 weeks. To create a strong material, Lucy added molecules from crustaceans such as crabs and lobsters and marine algae to her scales and skin mixture. The material is cheap to produce and uses very little energy.
Throughout the whole process, all of the temperatures are under 100 degrees. And if you think about it, I made this in my kitchen. So it's not a particularly high-tech process, which means that in terms of energy use, it's much lower than the plastic alternatives.
Lucy also wants the products to be processed close to the seaside to reduce CO2 emissions from their transport. She plans to use the $41,000 prize money to develop the product and prepare it for mass production. To win the prize, she had to beat off stiff competition from other designs, including an exoskeleton neck brace and a solar-powered pacemaker.
Richard Hamilton reporting. From drinking a glass of juice with medication to consuming a lot of herbal teas, there are many ways that cancer patients can accidentally reduce the effects of the drugs they're taking. That's according to a leading cancer surgeon who's now warning that some very common remedies could be interfering with things like hormone therapy or chemotherapy treatments. Professor Maria João Cardoso is head of breast cancer surgery at the Champalimau Cancer Centre in Lisbon and spoke to James Kumarasamy.
Cancer patients are one of the main population that try to use other types of treatments beside the conventional treatments. They seek for other solutions. They seek to take a little bit control on their hands of what they are going to do. The question is, herbal products have a distribution in our body that is not completely understood. And looking at the mechanisms, it can interfere with drugs that we use to treat cancer.
And when you say interfere, what do you mean specifically?
Making drugs that we use to treat cancer less effective, making them more toxic. Because, for instance, imagine you are taking a drug that's used to treat cancer and it's done through pills. So you ingest a drug and then, because you think like eating fruits and vegetables is very good, you drink a glass of grapefruit juice in the morning while you're taking the pills for the cancer treatment. The grapefruit juice, like tangerine juice and lime juice, can stop the absorption of this drug. So you think you are taking the exact amount of drug that you want, and you're not.
So things like citrus fruit juices,
yeah.
What else might get in the way or might make
everything,
drugs less effective?
So if, for instance, you are having what we call St. John's wort tea, when you have red clover, for instance, when you have green tea, everything can interfere. Of course, if you ask me, if you take a cup of green tea per day, possibly that is not going to interfere. But if you take, like many patients do, a liter of green tea per day, that can interfere with the absorption of these oral taken drugs for cancer. It's so important for us that there is a chance to give this information to patients because, as you possibly know, patients like to blog between each other about this that I can buy in the internet that is good for me because it boosts immunity, etc., etc. And we don't know.
So the message is what? That cancer patients should be talking to their doctors, their surgeons, rather than to each other?
Yeah, and the other way around is also true. Doctors need to ask and patients need to mention. We have several other types of complementary medicine that are not herbs and natural products, like acupuncture, acupressure, yoga, relaxation. These type of therapies help a lot in controlling mood, depression, even pain, and they don't interfere with treatments for cancer.
Professor Maria João Cardoso. Still to come on this podcast.
I think anyone would be angry and upset that anybody can exploit women for their own gains.
Police in Britain rescue 29 women from human traffickers. The International Criminal Court has approved a request from its prosecutors to investigate crimes against humanity directed towards Myanmar's Rohingya minority. More than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled to neighbouring Bangladesh since 2017. Myanmar maintains it didn't force anyone to leave. And Barisan Ethirajan, our South Asia editor, spoke to DVRA about the exodus.
Hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims, they fled violence in Myanmar after the Myanmar army started its action against what they described as the militants from the Muslim group there. You know, the western part of Myanmar is where the Rakhine state, where Muslims live in large numbers. They are a minority in Myanmar, and this region borders Bangladesh. And there have been systematic violence against them for the past 3 decades, and the UN describes them, you know, the one of the most persecuted minorities in the world. And in 2017, the violence was so big that hundreds of thousands of people, more than 750,000, fled to Bangladesh. And they have been, you know, living there in various refugee camps. And this attracted global attention because people have not seen this kind of exodus in recent times. And that really attracted world attention. But Myanmar always denied these allegations that they were forcing these people to leave. You have to understand, within Myanmar, when I was there, and also in Bangladesh, you know, the Myanmar people do not consider Rohingyas part of Myanmar. They think they were immigrants from Bangladesh who settled during the British colonial time, and they cannot be given citizenship. This has been a predominant view among the many Myanmar people. Now, Myanmar has been condemned by, you know, many nations, but still now they're not willing to take back many of these people. So they, even though they say they have reached an agreement with Bangladesh to taking back some of these refugees, still there is a big issue about how these people can go back, whether they can have citizenship. And this is the background to this ICC's ruling today.
And what does the ruling say? And I was quite interested to understand, when Myanmar is not part of the ICC, how will the ruling have impact?
Now, this is a significant development because many world nations have been calling on the United Nations Security Council to refer Myanmar to the International Criminal Court because, you know, this has some people who allegedly committed these atrocities should be brought to justice. But then the Security Council is dominated by countries like Russia and China, who are supporters of Myanmar. Now, the ICC on its own is asking the prosecutor to investigate these allegations. And this is very, very important because even though this may not be against the country, this may be against some of those generals who led this action against these people. So in that case, it becomes very, very significant. Myanmar is not a party to the ICC, the criminal court, but what the ICC says, there are some cross-border crimes because, you know, many people fled into Bangladesh, and Bangladesh is a member of the ICC, and that's why it says it has jurisdiction over this case.
Our South Asia editor, Ambarasan Ethirajan. Germany has dodged recession, but only just. On Thursday, it posted a surprise 0.1% of growth. It was widely expected to just tip into recession. As to the cause, well, it's got a lot to do with the global economic uncertainty gripping major German trading partners such as China, the US, Turkey and Sweden. This is taking a toll on output, profit margins and company balance sheets. Mercedes-Benz, for example, plans to save $1.8 billion by cutting more than 1,000 jobs. Damien McGuinness has taken a walk down a busy shopping street in Berlin.
This busy shopping street in the centre of Berlin looks as bustling as ever. The cafe in front of me is full, and all the shops I can see from here are packed with customers. Some of them even have signs in the window saying they're looking for staff. Now, that's because despite all the talk of a possible recession in Germany, figures show that consumers here are still spending. Unemployment is at a record low and people's wages are rising. Plus, low interest rates mean there's little incentive for consumers to save. So they are definitely still spending. But surveys also show that consumer confidence about the future is looking a lot less certain. German exports have been hit hard by the trade war between the US and China, and German manufacturers are nervous about the uncertainties around Brexit. So a lot of decisions are on hold. And although unemployment is still low, it's stopped falling. And we've also seen quite a few headlines in the German press recently about job losses, particularly in the car industry and banking. Now, none of that appears to have filtered down to the high street yet, and domestic consumption is still a driving force within the German economy. But if the nervousness among business leaders translates into widespread job losses next year, there are predictions that the German spending spree could grind to a halt.
Damien McGuinness in Berlin. Online influencers can be seen selling slim teas, lip glosses and holiday destinations across all social media platforms. And while some experts thought their ability to make money collaborating with brands would fade over time, in fact, the opposite seems to be happening. A new report suggests that the money earned by the Instagram models, YouTubers and bloggers has risen meteorically in the last few years. The marketing firm Isaiah found the average price of a sponsored photo on Instagram has jumped from $130 in 2014 to $1,600 this year. Our technology reporter Jane Wakefield told me more.
I think it really is just a reflection of how they recognise an awful lot of their customers, especially their younger customers, are on social media a lot and are looking at people that use social media, the celebrities, these micro-influencers who are people with fewer than 100,000 followers, and they're seeing what they're doing in their lifestyles and if their lives, they want their lifestyles to reflect a similar kind of pattern.
And this is more effective now than what you might call traditional advertising, because that feels like you're being sold something, and this feels more like it's being recommended by a friend or someone you have a connection with?
Exactly. Someone I spoke to earlier described it as the digital equivalent of word of mouth. You might in the past have had a friend or somebody that you would go to and say, what phone would you recommend that I upgraded to? Now we look to celebrities. Of course, this is a fine thing to do as long as we know that what they're doing is recommending products because they've been paid for them rather than because they personally think they're great products. And that's where it becomes a bit of a grey area.
And is the market saturated now, or can anyone decide they're going to be an influencer and try and set themselves up to make money from doing this?
I think there's always room for more, isn't there? I mean, if you look at the way celebrity curves works, people go in and out of fashion. I mean, I know I'd quite like to earn some of this money myself. So, you know, there'll be lots of people out there working in all kinds of fields that would very much like to join this. And youngsters like young people, so more will come along all the time, I should imagine.
And a new aspect of it is that companies are now not only paying huge celebrities with large numbers of followers to do this, but people with quite small followings.
Yeah, I mean, we see these niche bloggers that write, say, for instance, mummy bloggers who will write lots of things about their own children. They become very popular, and then they're seen as a good way of endorsing brands for children, nappies and all the rest of the paraphernalia that goes along with having kids. So, you know, brands are getting very clever at targeting specific groups of people with specific products, and they see it as a good way to reach a new audience.
Our technology reporter, Jane Wakefield. 29 women have been rescued in raids across London targeting a gang suspected of trafficking women from Romania. 19 people were arrested, and cash, drugs and a stun gun were recovered during the operation. Our correspondent Gareth Furby was with the police as they carried out the raids.
Before dawn in East London, police targeted 16 properties. Some, they believe, have been used as brothels.
Police!
Inside this flat, they found two women. At another address, another 27. The police believe they were trafficked to London from Romania to work on the streets. Inspector Barry Baylor joined today's operation.
I've got sisters. I've got a daughter. I think anyone would be angry and upset that anybody can exploit women for their own gains in this way.
Today's raids followed complaints from residents in parts of North and East London about sex working, which they said was out of control in their neighbourhoods. Some even set up their own street patrols.
Having their sexual acts in people's front gardens, in their alleyways.
The police responded, but residents said the activity just moved into brothels. British police worked in cooperation today with officers in Romania, where one man was detained. In London, the women found at the addresses were taken to a safe place and offered support.
Also here in London, a group of thieves has failed in its bid to steal valuable pictures from England's oldest public art gallery in a residential part of the city. The gallery in Dulwich says the intervention of security staff and police meant that two Rembrandts were recovered. Here's Vincent Dowd.
The exhibition Rembrandt's Light contains what the Dulwich Picture Gallery calls 35 of the artist's greatest paintings, etchings and drawings. Late on Wednesday, police were called after a security alarm was triggered. An intruder had forced entry and removed two paintings from the walls. After police officers gave chase, the intruder escaped, but both pictures were recovered on site. Some paintings in the show are on loan from institutions such as the Louvre in Paris, but the Dulwich hasn't yet said which pictures were involved.
Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd reporting. And that's all from us for now. There will be an updated version of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this edition, we'd love to hear from you. Drop us an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. My name's Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.